I'm joined in the studio today by Stephen De Silva, who's been with us before on a couple of occasions, once to talk about the story of Alban, whose name is rather important to the city of St. Albans, and secondly, to talk about Magna Carta and the role that the cathedral played in that in particular. And he's with me again because he's going to talk about the screen, the nave screen in the cathedral, because it is both topical and yet very, very ancient. Tell us what it sees and why. What's it there for?
Well, these screens were built to really divide the church up in different ways. The nave screen had a very practical purpose. It was to separate the monks who built this great abbey from the people who worshipped on the other side of it. And there's a powerful symbol in that screen, the two doors, which are the originals. They are fantastic survivals. 1350, we're talking about here. Woodwork very rarely survives that long. The two doors have only got handles on the monk's side. If you're symbolically cut off, if you're on the people's side.
Because the people would have been either standing or kneeling on the ground. There weren't pews or seats. Whereas the monks would have been literally in the choir?
Yes, they would have had carved choir stalls. What you see today, if you go into the abbey, are the Victorian ones. But they're kind of a reproduction of what you'd have had in the Middle Ages. But you're right, the people would have stood or knelt, and that expression, go to the wall, apparently comes from the old days when the elderly were allowed to go and rest against the wall during these very long services that they sat through.
Which, so of course, were in Latin.
Yes, in Latin, and probably went on for 2 or 3 hours. So quite common to let the elderly go to the wall.
Okay. You say that the screen is there, it functions as a separation between the people and the monks, but is that its only function?
It was also decorative. These screens had to provide inspiration for a largely illiterate group of worshippers. So stained glass windows, carved screens, statues of the saints or of Christ, all of these were there to help teach people their Bible stories. St. Augustine, when he came to Britain, made it very clear that people needed to be taught the stories, so teach them in pictures if they can't read.
Was there a priest or somebody their side of the screen?
Yes, there were. If you go into the nave area today, there are all those wonderful wall paintings on the walls and here and there. You have to imagine a little small altar at the base of every one of those pillars. And there'd have been a priest there probably on the hour, every hour, saying a service, saying mass. Pilgrims and people would wander in, gather round. Even though the screen divided them, it was not a screen that kept the priests out. The priests very much moved in and mingled with the people and taught them.
Then there was this ability to go into the church at any time, and there would be somebody there that you could participate in some sort of worship.
Pretty much so, because we have to remember St. Albans was a huge pilgrimage centre. So there'd be people arriving probably in the town most days wanting to go and visit the shrine of St. Alban. So what you did was stop off in Waxhouse Gate, which many people still know, buy yourself a candle. That's where the wax bit comes from. Take your candle down to the cathedral. Now, if you were poor like you and I, you'd just buy a very small candle. If you were wealthy, you were measured for a candle. In other words, you bought a candle the same height as yourself to demonstrate that you could afford something rather grand. You bought this candle, you took it into the abbey, you went to wherever one of the priests was saying the mass, and you offered the candle at the moment when it was appropriate to do so. So this was your offering to worship. Because you often couldn't speak Latin or take part in the service, you took part through symbolic gestures like offering a candle or taking communion.
The screen, I mean, this, you said 1350, so it's 670-ish years old. How has it survived? It must have been through some difficult times.
It really is very crumbly. There are parts of it that are indeed, they look like broken teeth, I would describe. We've restored a few bits and pieces, but we have left it in its damaged state. You have to remember that when the Reformation happened, the Puritans were really keen on destroying anything visual. God was only to be worshipped in spirit and in the mind. So statues and stained glass were, you know, clearly out, as were the wall paintings. So it's in a pretty damaged state. But two remarkable things, really. The doors survive, as I've already mentioned, and that's unusual. But we took a bold decision to restore some statues to it. First time an English cathedral has restored painted statues to one of its screens.
Are you saying there were no statues there when this latest process started?
Those statues would have been pulled out, we think, certainly by the time of Oliver Cromwell. They may have gone earlier, but there's clear evidence they were gone by the Commonwealth. So yes, it was bare from 1650 right up to last year.
Why did you choose these particular statues then?
Well, we wanted to tell the story of martyrdom. Alban is Britain's first saint. He's Britain's first martyr, the first person who dies for his faith. And we felt it was important in the cathedral to tell the story of martyrdom through our historic martyrs like Alban, but also to remind people that people do still give up their lives for their beliefs. You know, many Christians in the Middle East suffer, you know, persecution. Think of Egyptian Copts and people like that. And so we deliberately chose seven new martyrs who would tell our story here in St. Albans, our local story, but also a wider story of martyrs in the 20th century. We have two sets of good local martyrs. If I just perhaps check them off for you. Yeah. We have Alban and Amphibolus, the beginning of it all. Alban gives up his life for this Christian priest who's wandering about. But Amphibolus, the priest, also suffers martyrdom subsequently. So they're both on the screen. They're remembered there.
This is the man in the cloak.
The man in the cloak, absolutely, the cloaked one. Then later on come the Reformation period. You have those awful wars between the Protestants and the Catholics, each side attempting to destroy the other or take control. St. Albans figures very interestingly in that we have a martyr from each side. People don't often know all the stories. We have a baker from Barnet who gives up his life in the reign of Queen Mary. When Mary is busy burning Protestants at the stake, at Tankerfield is burned at Romeland, just outside the cathedral. But within 50 or 60 years, a Catholic priest is imprisoned in the Great Gateway at St. Albans. And then he is taken down to Tyburn in London, and he is executed for being a Catholic priest at a time when that was illegal.
And that was Elizabeth's reign, was it?
It was actually a little bit later, James I.
Oh, James I, okay.
A little bit later. It was important, I think, for us to remind ourselves that Christians have been pretty horrible to each other over the centuries, and we need to ask for forgiveness of each other for all the terrible things we've done to each other. So really, having St. Alban Roe, the Catholic, and Tankerfield, the Protestant, was a reminder of that terrible division.
I think that leaves three others.
Three more, and those three more are very special to us. They're three 20th century martyrs. They come from across the world and across the different Christian traditions, and you probably know at St. Albans we have a Roman Catholic Mass every week. We have a Russian Orthodox liturgy once a month, Baptist services, Methodist services, whatever else, German Lutheran services. So we chose three martyrs from the 20th century to remind us about modern martyrdom, but also to represent three of our ecumenical congregation. If I do them in historical order, we have a St. Elizabeth of Russia who died in 1918, a Russian Orthodox woman. She's actually Prince Philip's great aunt. That's actually the connection. She was a member of the British royal family, but she married into the Russian aristocracy. Her husband was assassinated. She gave up all her wealth, all her possessions. She sold everything, including her wedding ring, and set up an orphanage for poor women and children in Moscow, which she ran right up into the revolution. But because she was connected to the royals, she was pulled out of her monastery and assassinated at the time that the rest of the Russian royal family were. So she gave up her life for her beliefs there. Then in the Second World War, many people know the story of Adolf Hitler and his, what's the best word? Nazification of the church. You know, turning the church into a kind of Nazi propaganda. Well, a lot of Germans didn't want to do that. And one of those was a man called Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who held out against Hitler and, in fact, was faced with a great dilemma. What do I do? Do I stay loyal to my country, or do I fight against this corrupt leader, this leader who is destroying so many others? Bonhoeffer chose to follow what he saw as the path of right. And so he was executed just before the end of the war.
He was in prison for quite a long time, wasn't he?
A very great deal. And many people thought he would survive the war. But in fact, he was executed 2 weeks before the end of the war at Flossenbürg. A very sad end. His writings are hugely important. And in fact, one of our sister churches down in London is the Bonhoeffer Church, the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Church.
Because this really was the struggle between the state and the religion, as it were.
Absolutely.
The age-old issue that you've talked about in the Reformation, in a sense, that battle.
It's always there. What do you do? Because the Bible Bible's really clear. Parts of it say, obey the civil authorities. God has put them there. But at some point, you know, the individual has to say, do I really obey this person? Has God really put that person there? Mm-hmm. That was the dilemma Bonhoeffer faced.
Yes, and he writes about this very, very movingly. Okay, so you've got a Russian Orthodox, you've got a Protestant pastor, Nazi Germany time. Who's the third one, the final one?
The third one is a Roman Catholic. He's Oscar Romero, Archbishop of El Salvador, who dies in 1980. And he's a really interesting character because he was appointed to be a safe pair of hands. I think the rulers of El Salvador wanted an archbishop who wouldn't rock the boat. Everybody was really happy with Oscar Romero because he had a reputation for being a quiet, meek person. But once he's in position, it's really interesting. He sees the poverty. He sees the damage that the state is doing to the poor, and cannot refrain from speaking out. So he starts preaching about justice. He starts preaching about a fair wage for the workers of El Salvador. And sadly, one day when he's celebrating Mass at the altar, a man enters the back of the church with a gun. Romero saw him. The people who were present say, many of whom are still alive, say that he flinched, but he didn't stop saying the Mass and was assassinated as he was conducting the service and became the latest of our 20th century martyrs.
Yes, and he was very much a forerunner in that Latin American search for a church of poverty, if I can put it that way.
Very much so. A kind of understanding that sometimes the gospel and the church have to be radical a little bit, you know, and say that the poor are really where you know, the church should be directing its attention. You know, everyone has a soul, well, you know, poor or not. But sometimes the poor are forgotten in this great rush for control or power. He championed them very much so.
Interesting collection, then, of seven saints. But it's not just that you've put statues back. You've done more than that, haven't you, to them? They're not just plaster cast, as it were.
No, we went for something rather radical. If you go into most churches in England since the Reformation, there are plain stone statues. But these plain churches that we see today, that's really from about 1550 onwards. In the Middle Ages, churches were highly decorated and beautifully coloured. And so we took the decision to go for painted statues, to actually go for lifelike colour on these statues. And that was quite a radical thing to do. It's taken us over 10 years, actually, to get that project to fruition because, you know, the number of times we had to argue our case about why we wanted something like that, why we wanted something bold. And it was important that these saints kind of completed the family of God, if you like. So that's what they represent. So they're brightly coloured. They are painted in naturalistic colours. We thought there'd be a Marmite effect, you know, half people would hate them, half would love them. In fact, it's about 95% approval, I have to say. Occasionally when I'm on duty as a guide, someone says, oh, why did you go for such garish colours? But actually, most people like the sense of realism, I suppose.
Do you have any evidence what colour they would have been if they'd been painted in 1350, as it were?
We don't in the cathedral, but actually Winchester Cathedral, which has some very similar statues to ours from that period, does have traces of colour, and they were very vivid colours. Flesh tones still survive on the skin, red and gold on the robes. So things would have been quite highly decorated. And what this has created is a real focus. You come in at the far end of the abbey, look up, and there's this seven brightly coloured figures in the distance, kind of hopefully drawing you in and inspiring you a little bit.
Were they put in their painted form? They were installed in their painted form. So this was 2015.
Yeah, they went in almost their finished state. Rory Young, the wonderful sculptor who did them for us, Rory put final touches to the statues in position. But fundamentally, they'd been carved and painted elsewhere. And there are some wonderful photographs of Rory at work. He's worked with not just stone. So, for example, Alban's cross that he holds is metallic because it represents a metallic cross. There's a book being held by the Protestant Tankerfield, absolutely faithful copy of an Elizabethan Bible. And there are all these lovely details.
A couple of pairs of glasses.
Well, there are, yeah, on either side. And actually, there's a fantastic picture of the Romero statue, the statue of Oscar Romero, being taken to the opticians to be fitted for his glasses. And I think the optician said that was a first for him, really, to be fitting a saint.
So therefore, the nave screen has been opened with these seven statues, and it was an event in 2015. Did you have any dignitaries coming to launch it?
Well, we did indeed. indeed. We had, actually, just to mention, first of all, we had the Waldocks there. The Waldocks are the donors of the statues. They very kindly gave these statues to the cathedral, and that was a very generous gift. 2015 was also the 900th anniversary of the Normans arriving in St. Albans. And so we look back at the historical record, and 900 years ago, Richard, Bishop of London, was present when the building was dedicated. Well, we thought it'd be rather nice to invite Richard, Bishop of London, in 2015, to come along and dedicate these statues. And in fact, Richard Charters, who is the Bishop of London, he was here as a young priest in the days of Robert Runcie, when Robert was Bishop of St. Albans. Richard was his chaplain. And so we've invited him back. He's the third most senior clergyman in the Church of England after the two archbishops. And it was wonderful to have him to come and dedicate these statues for us. He put on a great spectacle for us, I think. I don't know if you've ever seen
it. But he was very colourful as well.
He was indeed. He's a tall, imposing man and with a great presence. And it was a wonderful way of marking 900 years of the Norman Abbey being there. People come in all the time asking to see about them. We were broadcast on the BBC at Easter. They formed a great focus there. And we found the week afterwards, people were coming in. They're a great focus for our pilgrimage as well. We have two or three pilgrimages. But the big one, the Alban pilgrimage, with a great procession down through the town of St. Albans, starting at up at St. Peter's Church and coming down. And the martyrs really focus, you know, the mind on that. So that's a great event. And increasingly now, people of St. Albans turn out for that, even if they just turn out for the great procession with these enormous, they're about 25-foot high carnival puppets that walk down through the town. It's become a bit of a spectacle. The number of people who say, oh, that's why we're called St. Albans, is really nice. So we're telling our town story as well as our church story.
Because it is, the procession is a mix of those who've come perhaps from further afield. I mean, it's not just local people, is it?
No.
People who come to St. Albans because of its originator, and they wish to do the pilgrimage to the Abbey.
They do.
So you have the civic leaders in there as well. It's a procession of all sorts.
It really is. And it's great to have worked with the local council to create Alban Weekend, because that's on the Saturday, and on the Sunday, the council hold a great celebration of Albantide with a big picnic in the centre of town and all the rest of it. So it's become a great... It's nice to see a local festival like that kind of develop and become very popular. We deliberately always try and have one Church of England preacher and somebody from a different Christian tradition. So
great, Stephen. Thank you very much for that. We're going to look at the next time you come in, we're going to talk about the other screen, the one, as it were, at the back of the building, by the altar screen, and we'll discover some more about what screens are for and what they're all about. Thank you very much.
Thank you.